The meningitis outbreak caused by 3 lots of contaminated steroids from the New England Compounding Center in Framingham, Massachusetts, has now killed 24 people and sickened more than 320. Every day, the website for the Centers for Disease Control shows more and more cases being reported. According to the most recent numbers from the CDC, Michigan has at least 80 confirmed cases. Then comes Tennessee with around 70. But the state with the next highest rate of infection has only about half that number of patients. Dr. Lakshmi Halasamani is chief medical officer at St. Joseph Mercy Hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan, where most of the meningitis victims in Michigan are being treated. And doctor, why have Michigan and Tennessee been hit so hard?
So the Tennessee cases and the Michigan cases share a common lot number in terms of the steroids that were injected. So both sets of patients in Tennessee and Michigan received injections from the same lot number of the contaminated lots. There were 3 lots that were identified as contaminated by the New England Compounding Company. And the reason that the majority of cases are in Michigan and Tennessee is that it was felt that one of those 3 lots had greater virulence than the other two, and those two mapped to Tennessee and Michigan.
So this is really just the very bad luck of the draw, essentially.
Correct.
What exactly happens when a patient comes to your hospital showing symptoms of meningitis? What kind of tests or exams or screenings are done?
So, you know, early on in the epidemic, as patients presented, we, you know, looked for the traditional signs and symptoms of meningitis, which include headache, fever, nausea and vomiting, visual changes. And what's important to recognize is that the manifestation of this fungal infection has evolved from being only meningitis to now involving other kinds of symptoms as well, including strokes, localized infections around the spinal cord known as epidural abscess. For patients who received injections into joints, we are seeing joint infections. So the presentation now is very a little bit broader.
And why is that? Why are you seeing symptoms you might not normally see when a case of meningitis walks in the door?
Well, what's critically important to understand is that the pathogen that's causing this meningitis isn't a normal human pathogen. It is a pathogen that is found primarily in soil. And in general, we have very little scientific understanding of its causes of human disease. So we're learning about how this fungus causes human disease. We don't have, you know, many years of experience, if you will, in treating patients with this type of fungal infection because it really hasn't been described as a human infection before.
In terms of what's happening inside a person's body when they get meningitis, what is the progression of the illness?
Meningitis is an infection of the meninges, which is the lining of the brain and spinal cord. So what occurs is that that lining becomes inflamed, and instead of the fluid being sterile, it becomes infected with bacteria and bacterial meningitis, but in this instance, with the fungus. And the source of that infection in this instance was the injections themselves, because the medication is injected into the space right around the spinal cord or where the spinal fluid resides. So really, there's a direct portal of entry that led to these infections.
As I understand it, fungal meningitis is not necessarily a death sentence, but it is very serious, and even the drugs used to treat it can have terrible side effects. So what should patients being treated for this brace themselves for?
Some of the side effects are nausea and vomiting, abnormal liver function tests, kidney toxicity, chest pain, and rigors.
And rigors are?
Rigors are sort of a shaking of the body.
Like a seizure, almost.
Really, it's more like a...
Tremors.
It's like a total body tremor.
Mm. As we know, it seems to be contaminated steroids that were injected into people's backs or joints that cause this. And the idea that some of the country's drug supply may not be safe is obviously a very frightening thought. What's your reaction as a doctor to this contamination?
I'm quite bewildered and very disappointed because I think all of us in healthcare have implicit faith in the products that we use and especially the ones that we give to our patients. So I think it really makes us pause and think about what are the supply chains for the medications and other therapeutics that we prescribe and deliver to patients, and how do we ensure that the regulation that surrounds those supply chains is adequate and consistent across the country? Because I think all of us, just like we turn on the faucet, we just assume the water supply is safe. We have the same sort of trust in the pharmaceuticals and therapeutics that we prescribe and that we provide to our patients.
And do you feel like you have any control over that, or do you just sort of feel a bit helpless and you just have to trust and hope that trust is well placed?
Well, you know, I work within a large health system, so in my role, I feel as though I have influence over the kinds of relationships we have and the supply chain options. But I think for many physicians who may work in smaller practices or settings where perhaps they have many degrees of separation, if you will, from the folks who make those decisions, they do put a lot of trust and faith in those processes. And I think the individuals within organizations that make these purchasing decisions are putting a lot of faith in the manufacturers and in the suppliers. So I think what's come to light is that there's really two standards of oversight, one that involves the FDA and one that doesn't, and that probably does need to be addressed moving forward.
Dr. Lakshmi Halasamani is Chief Medical Officer at St. Joseph Mercy Hospital in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Doctor, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks very much, Sasha.
We'll be back after a 60-second break to talk about how the investigation of this meningitis outbreak will play out. And later in the show, the Obama administration's kill list and the drone program that targets the terrorist suspects on that list. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about the national meningitis outbreak that's killed 24 people and sickened more than 320. And we were just speaking with the chief medical officer at St. Joseph Mercy Hospital in Michigan, the state that currently has the most infections. She raised the question of how oversight of our drug supply may be changed by this crisis. So with us now to talk about that and the next steps in the investigation is reporter Martha Biebinger, who's been covering the story for our home station, WBUR. Hi, Martha.
Hi, Sasha.
Martha, there are several state and federal agencies involved in this investigation. Who exactly is looking at what?
The investigation is being led jointly by the Federal Food and Drug Administration and at the state level here by the Department of Public Health out of Boston. Now, their findings will be reviewed for possible criminal and civil charges. And in fact, we know that federal investigators through the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Boston are sort of watching. They're in there now, keeping an eye on what's going on so that they can make an initial determination themselves about whether to move forward with any charges.
It was fungus that somehow got into these steroids, these vials of steroids that the company shipped out. Is it known yet how the fungus got in there?
No, we don't know the root cause yet. What we do have is some preliminary results of the investigation that Governor Deval Patrick here in Massachusetts released on Tuesday. Those found problems with quality and safety, dirty floor mats and hoods. They found that some of this steroid had been shipped out before the sterility had been tested and confirmed. And what we know that they're moving forward with is to try to figure out, they found little black particles floating in some of the vials that had been recalled of this steroid.
Visible to the eye,
visible to the eye, that's correct. But what are they exactly, and how did they get in there? That's where the investigation is continuing now.
So as you said, this center was found to have sterilization problems, sort of basic safety violations. And there had been complaints about this company before, the New England Compounding Center, even before the meningitis outbreak. What were those previous complaints about?
Well, we know that going back 10 years ago to 2002, there was a complaint about an adverse reaction from this same steroid. As far as we know, it was just a single complaint, but it rolled into an investigation of the company and some of the poor record keeping and poor safety measures that we're now seeing again, of course, at a much larger scale. Now, in 2002, the investigation continued through into 2004, and it was not until 2006 that they actually had a consent decree. The state agency had originally said, look, we need a 3-year probation period. We need a reprimand. We're seeing a serious pattern here. The attorney for the company then, Sasha, said, if you do that, it will kill our business. And someplace in that interaction, with monitoring from an outside agency that we now know was under federal investigation themselves, the state backed off.
So as early as long as a decade ago, there may have been some sign that more oversight was needed here.
Right. Not to the extent that we're seeing now, but yes.
So for the sake of review, this is a specialty pharmacy. This isn't like Walgreens or CVS. This is a so-called compounding pharmacy.
That's right.
Remind us how this fits into the industry of manufacturing drugs and vaccines.
So you have your corner pharmacy that fills your general prescriptions, and then you have the big manufacturers, Merck, et cetera. And in between are what are called compounding pharmacies, who make special, they're supposed to make specialized prescriptions that are unique to each patient. So you, Sasha, may not be able to take pills in the tablet form. You may need a liquid form. You may have a child that will only take cherry-flavored medicine. Maybe you're allergic to a specific ingredient in a medication. So you go, or you have the prescription sent to a compounding pharmacy where they make it specific to you. Now, these compounding pharmacies are not supposed to be doing this in bulk. They're not supposed to be manufacturers, and they're not licensed to do that. But some have been doing that, in part to fill drug shortages that many hospitals are complaining about. And it's that step beyond what they are licensed to do that appears to be causing the problem.
That it was basically producing drugs on a bulk scale when
it
shouldn't have been. So so if it was doing that, who ultimately had oversight of the company and should have said, you're not supposed to be doing that?
That's where the gray area is. That's where the legislators, lawmakers feel that they have to step in, because the state license says individual prescription, but if the company is manufacturing in bulk outside of the state, does the state license apply then? That's the company says no. That's where they found some room to maneuver.
So what kind of system reforms, if any, could result from this big failure in medical safety?
Well, we're seeing things at both the state and the federal level. So at the federal level, we have hearings with two different committees. We have lawmakers looking at legislation that would try to clarify exactly what a compounding pharmacy can and cannot do. That legislation may also, as Dr. Halasimani was talking about, it may also offer warnings to patients that drugs produced at these compounding pharmacies are not FDA approved.
So that's federal level. What about state level?
So at the state level, the laws vary from state to state. Some states are already going in and inspecting compounding pharmacies, looking at quality and safety. In Massachusetts, that wasn't happening, unannounced inspections really until this week. So on a state-by-state basis now, you're going to see states reviewing what their rules say and whether they need to be adjusted.
The last time Congress tried to establish new regulations involving these compounding pharmacies was 2007 by the late Senator Ted Kennedy. What happened to that effort?
Well, it didn't go anywhere, and it didn't go anywhere in part because of strong lobbying by the compounding, by the association that represents compounding pharmacies. And in fact, what Senator Kennedy was trying to do was close a loophole that had been created by a 1997 law. But a lot of what happens here, Sasha, is this conflict between the small pharmacies who are following the rules, are doing the right thing, are important often in their communities as job creators and as providers of drugs.
And probably don't want to be overregulated.
And don't want to be overregulated against people who are pushing the boundaries and, as we see here, creating problems.
As we heard Dr. Halasimani say earlier, most patients operate on the assumption they can trust the system. Drugs are delivered to their doctor. They let them be injected into their back or neck. Some legislators are suggesting this is the tip of the iceberg because there are many compounding pharmacies out there operating outside of their license. How much of a concern is that?
I think it raises a lot of concerns because many of us and many of our doctors don't know the source of the medications that we take. But the point is that we need to start asking a lot more questions.
Martha Biebinger is a healthcare reporter for WBUR here in Boston. Martha, thank you.
Thank you, Sasha.
For more of Martha's reporting on this story, go to hereandnow.org. Monday on the show, the economy and the race for the White House. We'll be joined by the New York Times' David Leonhardt. Also, our resident chef, Kathy Gunst, drops by with pumpkins on the menu. That's Monday, and the news is next here and now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by Harvard University, whose Harvard Extension School has online and on-campus courses for students around the world, extension.harvard.edu, and the Institute of Contemporary Art Boston, with Os Gêmeos, colorful dynamic paintings by Brazil's most renowned street artists, on view now, icaboston.org.